This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
For many, protective equipment is a necessity. For others, it is an annoyance. But for some, it is part of their identity. You wouldn't know who they were apart from their armor. It is what makes them unique. It's how they stand out from the crowd. For these titans, their armor is not simply a safety measure. It is an extension of themselves. No less important than an arm or a leg or any other body part. And in some cases, even more important. It's more than simply blast-resistant material to deflect an enemy onslaught. It's a symbol, a message, if you will. One that communicates more to those who witness it than 1,000 words ever could.
You are listening to the Star Lores Podcast.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Why, you stuck up, half witted, scruffy looking nerf herder!
But I was going into Tosche Station to pick up some power converters.
Mandalorian armor.
I adhere to the Res Sulnare, the core of what it means to be Mandalorian, a sacred law giving us direction and purpose.
Education and armor, self-defense, our tribe, our language, our leader, all help us survive. We must educate our children as Mandalorians, obey the commands of Mandalore, speak Mandoa, and defend our clans.
It is difficult to overstate the significance of armor to Mandalorian culture. Indeed, it is far more than a style of clothing. It's etched into the Mandalorian code itself. According to the Six Tenets, or Res Sulnare, as it's called in their tongue, is the principles which were expected of all people, and they go as follows. 1. Speak the language. 2. Defense of oneself and one's family. 3. Raise one's children to be indoctrinated in the ways of the Mandalorians. 4. Contribute to the welfare and prosperity of one's clan. 5. Heed the call of Mandalore to raise an army for war. And finally, 6. One must wear the Mandalorian armor. There was even a Res Sulnare rhyme to help children remember the 6 actions. Education and armor, self-defense, our tribe, our language, and our leader all help us survive. Every point of the code was sacrosanct, and equipping oneself with the armor was just as much a religious act as a practical one. So much so that if a Mandalorian was stripped of his armor, or had it stolen or misplaced, it was one of the greatest shames one could endure. However, prior to some of the more modern versions of the armor, like Boba Fett's Duroplast plated armor, the equipment went through various phases and iterations throughout the Mandalorian's 10,000-year history.
The Tong Age. Prior to the Mandalorians becoming a multi-ethnic peoples, they began as one of the indigenous populations of Coruscant, a simian primate species with sharp claws and teeth called the Tong. After a devastating war with the native human population, they were forced to flee the planet and find a new home. After a period of exile and wandering, they found and settled on the world they would eventually call Mandalore. It is here that their fortunes would turn for the better, as they would make a discovery that would revolutionize metallurgy forever, when they unearthed the iron-like ore called Beskar. This element was special because of its light weight and incredible durability. who was nearly indestructible and could resist both blaster fire and lightsabers. It was also unique. Nothing like it has ever been found anywhere else in the galaxy, except for Mandalore and its moon, Concordia. This gave the Tong a total monopoly on the metal, with which they were able to forge vast fleets for their own empirical expansion, and equip throngs of soldiers with Beskar armor, as well as sell it to the wider galaxy for a high profit. The first generations of the armor were crude, made to look primal and intimidating, with each set being unique to its wearer. The plates were woven together and padded with leather, as well as spikes protruding from its surface. They were decorated in animal bones across the armor. It came with little to no technological enhancements, and the helmet was optimized for the Tong head, with a long and thin visor to cover the eyes, and an equally thin glass plate running down the nose and mouth. This style of helmet, mimicking the Tong skull structure, continues to present day in the tradition of Mandalorian armorsmiths.
The Crusader Age. As the Mandalorians began to expand their civilization, and with the rapid growth that came with Beskar, they started to subsume other cultures into their ranks. They started to indoctrinate the conquered peoples into the Rezolnare, and even offered subordinate species full-fledged and equal membership into Mandalorian society. This strategy was useful, as it was able to mitigate resentments of the conquered, and thus avoid uprisings and rebellions. They would, though, have to renounce their former cultural practices. With this came an evolution in the armor. Crusader armor was more uniform, and completely obscured what species was behind the helmet. Though there was still quite a bit of customizability, it was not a free-for-all. It was also heavier than the ancient form, using much more Beskar plating, covering far more surface area of the body. During the Mandalorian Crusades, they acted much more like shock troopers, viewing ranged battles as cowardice and preferred melee vibroblade warfare. This is one of the driving factors to more cumbersome but stronger plating. Furthermore, it also incorporated some technological features like optical enhancements in its visors and compartments to carry more weaponry. During the Neo Crusades, which occurred soon after the Jedi Civil War, Cassus Fett designed a newer version of the former Crusader armor, which held even more uniformity between suits than its predecessor in a bid to unite the desperate people that had become Mandalorians, so that they would see themselves as one single clan, united under the banner of Mandalore.
The Post-Mandalore Age. After the defeat at the hands of Darth Revan during the Mandalorian Wars, the people who were loosely held together by a set of higher ideals were now dispersed across the galaxy. Though the Mandalorian Empire would no longer exist, its presence as a cultural identity would continue throughout the millennia. Mandalorians would still be tied together by a powerful sense of belonging to their history and their code. They were found in pockets throughout the galaxy as mercenary companies and bounty hunters, still maintaining their battle-hungry honor culture. The armor style, however, would evolve yet again, and it was during this time that it would revert to be far more individualistic than it was during the Crusader era. Because they were no longer part of an empire, every Mandalorian would uniquely craft and color his armor, and would often wear much less of it, optimizing for agility over protection. The Mandalorian Super Commandos, led by Jaster Mareel, were one of the most well-known gun-for-hire groups who are accredited with the innovations and aesthetic that Mandalorian armor is known for today. With the shackles of conformity now stripped off of what constituted a set of the iconic armor, experimentation and innovation became commonplace. What really separated the modern versions from its progenitor was the technological enhancements, which would be retrofitted to the Beskar suits. They would be equipped with everything from jetpacks to guided rockets, Melee vibroblades, which could protract and retract inside the gauntlet, were often seen. The software in the heads-up display inside of the helmet also advanced dramatically, with many of them having the capability to track up to 30 targets at a time, view the infrared spectrum, and even have X-ray vision. As years passed and Beskar iron became more rare, many who followed the Mandalorian traditions would start using Durasteel, perhaps the strongest alloy next to Beskar. Both Jango and Boba Fett used Durasteel armor. But the amount of tech augmentations one could make with their armor was almost limitless for anyone willing to pay the credits, and this was especially true for the Fetts. Darth Vader's armor.
More of an exoskeleton than armor, the battle suit that belonged to Lord Vader was an image of dread throughout the galaxy. The glossy jet-black helmet, long dark cape, and the chilling sound of his respirator inhaling and exhaling was perhaps more recognizable than the Imperial crest itself. It was just as much a life support system, personal computer, and symbol as it was protective clothing. Possibly the most advanced piece of personal technology ever developed up to that point, with the incredibly complex and numerous systems that it ran on. Conceptually, the design itself was an upgraded version of its predecessor bodysuit, worn by General Grievous. Despite its capabilities, however, Vader himself was not very impressed with it, believing much of the systems in it to be crude and far from the cutting edge. Some of his prosthetic limbs were built with cheap and heavy material. The synth skin, which was meant to replace his charred biological skin, was irritating and often needed to be scrubbed and cleaned. The suit itself was cumbersome and inflexible, weighing in at 265 pounds, a far cry from what he was used to in his former life as Anakin Skywalker. The only way he was able to even wield the armor in battle was through the Force and the assistance of his mechanical limbs. Though it did offer a great deal of protection, and he couldn't have survived without the breathing apparatus, it felt to him more like a prison than an enhancement, which was supposedly to help him reach his full potential. The Dark Lord wondered to himself if the suit was intentionally designed in such a way as to be Palpatine's leash to keep the dog at heel. The aesthetic of the armor was modeled off the ancient battle armor which was worn by Sith lords in the old Sith Empire prior to 4000 BBY. In that day, they wore bulky heavy armor that could deflect most blaster fire and had a menacing appearance that was meant to strike terror in their foes. The Vader suit, however, though heavy, was lighter on plating than its ancient counterpart and outfitted with far more technological enhancements. The armor plates were made out of an alloy that mixed durasteel, obsidian, and plasteel to be maximally protective while not being unbearably heavy. Covering much of the armor was a fibrous black padded multiply body glove. Its appearance was deceptive though, looking like nothing more than a typical body glove worn by stormtroopers. It was in fact highly protective. Built in 10 layers, it had blast dampening material. It was fireproof, regulated temperature, and was hermetically sealed to protect from infection on his open wounds. A product called Rayflex, cellular padding, was built in the first layer and was basically a light armor in and of itself. The outer layer of the glove was a rechargeable energy suit that helped to absorb energy weapons. His cape, though light, was constructed with armor weave, a material often employed by bounty hunters for its good weight-to-protection ratio. Though not as strong as his body glove, the cape was able to absorb blaster fire and even lessen the blow of lightsabers. In the event he was in the situation where he was under heavy fire and could not reasonably protect himself with the Force or his lightsaber, he would be able to wrap his body with his cape to lessen the damage. His gloves were a variant of Mandalorian Crush Gaunt, made out of Beskar, which were incredibly strong and could resist lightsaber strikes. They also had the added benefit of augmenting the wearer's strength. His Durasteel boots were outfitted with a ferromagnetic core that, when activated with a control in his mouth, would enable him to easily walk on surfaces in low to zero gravity environments. The chest box that covered his torso was a primary computer which helped to regulate Vader's cardiopulmonary and neural systems, without which he could not survive. Should it be destroyed or stop functioning, his lungs and heart would stop within minutes. Throughout the suit were wires that connected to the unit, acting like a central nervous system, warning of damage to the suit or system failures. It also had the ability to regulate temperatures, even enabling him to walk the surface of Hoth with no additional layers. The battery inside of the chest box was powered with the impulse generators laced throughout the inside of his armor, which stimulated his extremely mangled muscles, granting him far more physical strength than the average man. The visor equipped in his mask also helped to dampen excessive light, which could further damage his already half-destroyed retinas. Among other things, it also gave him the ability to see the ultraviolet spectrum, night vision, and a number of other features like environmental data object identification readouts. The helmet and mask even assisted his hearing, which was also badly damaged on Mustafar. Though his sense of smell was one of the few senses which wasn't affected by his injuries, the mask gave him heightened olfactory abilities, even being able to block out and isolate specific scents. Suffice to say, Darth Vader could not have functioned in any way, much less survive, without his iconic suit of armor. Because of this, it was the perfect ploy for Sidious to exploit Anakin's force powers and tactical prowess, while keeping him in check as to not present a threat to his own position of power.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Royal Armor.
Throughout history, heads of state, dignitaries, and political bodies have had specialty protection from elite commandos who were set apart from the regular military. The protective equipment they use is often unique, of higher quality, and more striking visual features than typical soldiers. These are some of the most recognizable suits of royal armor.
Sun Guard. The Thrasians were ethnic Achaeans but split from the wider Achaeani Empire, and at some point in the 12th century BBY, they formed a highly specialized and feared group of mercenaries called the Sun Guard. Even after the fall of Thyrsus, the group continued as a company of bounty hunters and mercenaries, with even a religious and ideological bent to them, not unlike the Mandalorians of the same period. Their most notable assignment was that of the security detail for Darth Plagueis, under contract with Damask Holdings, and in the last years of the Republic, were considered a group of exclusively guarded high-profile individuals. The suit consisted of Achaeani plating, and was considered a heavy armor, but was still relatively easy to move around in. In the more modern iterations, the helmets resembled that of the Mandalorian Crusaders, and were outfitted with a macro-binocular scope, as the Sun Guard were well known as excellent marksmen and snipers. The most common color was black, but it was not unheard of to see them in suits of gold or silver.
Senate Royal Guard. The security detail assigned to the Republic Senate had a tradition on Coruscant dating back thousands of years, probably going through various aesthetic changes in that time. However, before they were eventually phased out by Palpatine during the Imperial period, they were known as donning long blue robes and a ceremonial Spartan-looking helmet while on the Senate grounds that was said to be inspired by Mandalorian armor. Though they could engage in combat if need be, the robes were not meant to be military in nature, but instead were symbolic. Every guard, though, did have an alternate set of blue armor that was essentially the same as the standard clone commando armor.
The Red Guard. Colloquially referred to as Red Robes, The Red Guard was formed shortly after Senator Palpatine was elected as Supreme Chancellor. Because he did not trust the Senate Royal Guard, which was typically tasked with the Chancellor's security detail, he formed his own group of elites, which he handpicked from a pool of Senate guards. As the name implies, the Red Guards differed from their Senate counterparts, in that the armor and robes were dyed red instead of blue, but shared all of the same armor materials and characteristics. With one notable exception, the Red Guards had their identities concealed with a visor, which covered their entire face, unlike the Blue Guards, whose faces were exposed. The helmet and mask was heavily influenced by Darth Plagueis' sun guard, and even had a hint of ancient Sith armor as well.
The Imperial Royal Guard. After the dissolution of the Senate and the establishment of the Galactic Empire, the Senate Guard was disbanded, and the Red Guard transitioned into the Imperial Royal Guard, becoming the official security detail for Palpatine. Though they were occasionally assigned to Grand Moffs, members of the Ruling Council, or even Darth Vader, their primary purpose was to guard the Emperor, and were often chosen from the ranks of the most elite stormtroopers. Like their progenitors, the Red Guards, they wore red armor and robes. In the case of the Imperial Royal Guard, though, they would always wear a ceremonial robe over top of their heavy plastoid battle armor, making it possible to remove the robe if the situation called for it. They also donned a set of red battle armor that was simply a stronger set of stormtrooper armor that they would wear on the rare occasion they were called to a field mission. The Imperial Royal Guard was viewed as an amalgamation of Sun Guard, Senate Royal Guard, Mandalorian Death Watch, and Sith armors.
Imperial Shadow Guard. Virtually the same to Imperial Royal Guard armor in every respect except for color, Shadow Guard armor was entirely black and was worn by Force-sensitive soldiers. These particular soldiers did not guard Palpatine, however. Instead, they were commissioned for specialty, top-secret missions by the Emperor himself.
Welcome aboard the Millennial Falcon. This is Jordan.
This is Christian.
Thanks for joining us again. We are here once again on Coruscant at the Armor Museum.
Oh.
And we have just done a beautiful and wonderful tour of all the ancient armors that have replicas, of course, because, you know, Darth Vader's armor. No one has the original.
Yeah, it got torched.
Allegedly. But some people claim they do.
They took pieces of the Death Star home, too.
Some people claim, but I think they're fakes. So, anyways. Hey, if you like the show, make sure that you check us out on social media. We are on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Discord. Connect with us if you have any thoughts, complaints. We won't listen. No, I'm just kidding. We might listen to them. And then, or just if you have any suggestions or any commentary on any of the lore that we talk about, we'd love to hear from you guys. Also, if you have like Star Wars collection, Star Wars fan fiction, Star Wars videos, anything that's like an original creation, we'd love to see it from you, and we will feature it on our
social
stuff. If you want to, if you guys are so inclined, please feel free. Also, if you want to support the show and keep this rust bucket flying, you can go to patreon.com/starlores, and you can support us there for $3 a month. If you're not interested in Patreon, you can also do the subscription option on Spotify itself, on the platform, and you could pay $3 a month and just get access to the bonus episodes, essentially. I think that's about it. So today we're talking another episode. This is like our second episode getting into the armor. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that's the second of probably more episodes to come.
One episode I'll have to see if there's enough content, but I am kind of interested is like ship armor.
Armor plating.
Yeah, so that might be a little academic and boring.
I was going to say, it's going to be super technical, yeah. Describing like the thickness of plates.
Yeah, I don't know if I can make it that interesting, but you know, maybe like a shorter episode would be fun to do.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, ship armor and stuff, at armor, vehicle armor, vehicular armor. Yeah, anyways. So before we get into the discussion here, I'm going to try and do the WrestleNare, the Mandalorian code in Mandalore.
Oh, okay. Hopefully no Mandalorians are listening to you butcher the language.
Yeah, so it goes like this. Bajur, Bal, Beskar, Gam, Aranov, Alit, Mandoa, Bal, Mandalore, and Venkuyan Mi. I think my accent was terrible.
A little
there.
Bit off, yeah.
But that is the WrestleNare in Mandalorian. So
sounds shorter than in English.
Yeah, it does. But that's it. That was the whole thing.
Well, you can memorize it and everyone can become a Mandalorian. Yeah,
exactly. So first thing, obviously, like it's interesting in the whole Mandalorian armor in like a lot of different suits of armor keeps coming up as like an inspiration, even in Darth Vader's a little bit. I didn't totally get into that, but there's even some Mandalorian armor inspiration.
I think that's just due to the timeless coolness of real life's Corinthian style helmets, the Greek helmets that everyone knows.
Yeah.
And then that obviously got translated into the Mandalorian armor, and then people just keep self-referencing it.
Yeah.
And then sometimes people realize they're referencing it maybe too much and try to do something different. But all roads lead to Mandalore,
yeah. It seems. It is funny. And I also, what's also interesting about Mandalorian armor, which probably of all suits of armor, it's like the most important, the most iconic, maybe next to Darth Vader's armor. But what is interesting about the Mandalorians is like, if you go into the lore, it really is, it's like metallurgy that is like what launches their civilization into prominence. And that's like, in the show, we like to do contrast with like the real world, and that is like how a lot of civilizations have just exploded out of nowhere is metallurgy, is like the discovery of a new metal.
Controlling the metal that exists,
controlling a source of metal, of ore, that where you can be it you know, tin or copper or iron, you know, back in the day. So I do like that they do that they wrote that into the lore, that like Beskar is part of what helped their civilization rise, you know?
Yeah, no, it's pretty true to life.
Yeah.
Kind of like controlling the stars is like controlling a navy. Same thing with controlling metal.
Yeah.
And advancements in metallic science, right?
Yeah, exactly. And another thing, you know, like, so I feel like I'm a little torn on this. There is, I know in like the Disney canon, it seems like very much like if you don't, especially with the Mandalorian show, like if you don't have Beskar iron, it's not real Mandalorian armor.
Yeah.
However, like Jango and Boba Fett
have Durasteel.
Yeah, both have Durasteel armor.
I think that comes from a visual dictionary, like before Beskar became super prominent.
Okay.
So back, it was kind of one of those retroactive things where like someone said it, now they kind of have to stick with it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I would say it's
like, is it legitimate Mandalorian armor if it's not Beskar?
It's hard to say.
Yeah.
I want to say I want to say yes, that it all Mandalorian armor can be Mandalorian armor. I think it's like the spirit of the law, right? As long as you don the armor. And especially as Beskar becomes more rare too, right? At some point it will become so rare that maybe you won't even have a full set of armor. Just like a thigh plate will be actual Beskar. So does that mean your culture dies with the material or?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And Mandalorians existed before the armor as well, right? Even though it is a central tenet, you know, the Mandalorian ideals were still there first. So I would say, yeah, actually, that changes my mind. I would say definitively, yes, that you can have non-Beskar Mandalorian armor.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I'm still on the fence about it. I think it does seem a little more like it holds a little more weight if you have Beskar.
Ironically, it would be lighter, though.
Yeah. Yeah, so symbolically more weight. Yeah. if you have more Beskar, or like you said, even one piece of Beskar. But
yeah, I think there's cultural value in the genuine material, but I don't think you should be outcasted if you don't have the true material either.
Yeah, fair enough. So I wanted to get a little, I think we maybe did get into this a little bit in our Darth Vader episode a few years back. People can go back and look at that. I think it's like episode in the teens or something, maybe the 20s. Just search Star Wars, Darth Vader, and you'll find it. It's the whole thing about Sith alchemy in Darth Vader's armor. I couldn't find any sources that confirm this.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things also that they...
But people seem to keep like assuming that there's alchemy it's involved. Imbued with yeah. Sith alchemy.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that like authors just throw out there as an assumption. It happens a lot with Sith alchemy. It's never detailed. It's like this item has Sith alchemy and this object that Sith use has Sith alchemy. And it could even be in, let's say, on a very base level, like maybe they imbued it with magics while they were crafting it. Mm. It doesn't have any kind of like it strengthens the metal that's already there. So like it wouldn't glow or do anything like fantastical, or at least anything you could perceive as fantastical, but maybe it's like stronger than it would otherwise have been with or magic. You know, if someone tries to use a force on him and it repels other magic, quote unquote, magic abilities, right?
I think, you could do even a little bit of headcanon too, like, because Vader's always using the force. There seems to be some indication that he uses the force to help him move, even in his armor. And also just like sort of that dark side energy all the time, like the hate is always running through him. And so like I know like in the Disney movies, there is sort of this thing with Darth Vader's helmet where Kylo Ren has the helmet, but he can like hear Darth Vader's voice through the helmet, you know, that there's almost
becomes like a channeling item.
Yeah, exactly.
Which makes no sense if you realize that Anakin's spirit should not be corrupt, but whatever. Yes. Ignoring the entire plot of episode 6.
That's right. It does seem to be almost like a haunted item, you know, and so I do wonder if just by like virtue of who he is and him using it,
like taints it.
Yeah. Could it be like, almost through osmosis, some sort of like Sith alchemy, you know? I mean, that's headcanon on my part, but
yeah, no, I think obviously alchemy being pre-scientific, you can always like quote unquote magic it away, right?
Yeah,
it's just a general vague magicness about it.
Yeah,
maybe it inspires more fear or terror into people.
And I have seen people like, there are people like, I've seen some writers, they like Sith alchemy armor, like it's a category in and of itself, but I don't think that that's actually how it works. Like it should just be like, it could be any object.
Yeah, imbued with magic.
Yeah, just imbued with,
that's all. It could be a t-shirt, or it could be
it could be plates. Stormtrooper armor, and it could be Sith alchemy armor, right? Yeah. Like I don't think it's like a category in and of itself.
Yeah, no, it's just had like a spell cast over it or whatever, which would put it under that category, but it could be composed of many different things.
Yeah.
And also just the idea of alchemy, again, just from the real world, being that like changing of transubstantiation of material, being a big component. So just calling everything Sith alchemy, like maybe Vader's plates used to be one material and they converted into something different, right? Yeah. Like, yes, alchemy is magic, but it's not that magical. Like I said, it's like a pre-science.
Yeah.
It's chemistry before chemistry was a thing.
Exactly. Just another kind of note is I was just reading like behind the scenes, so armor weave, I did talk about how like Vader's cape is armor weave, but there's armor weaves all throughout lots of people use
anything that kind of feels like or appears to be like a armored fabric.
Like a protective fabric is armor weave. I was reading, it was basically someone wanted something like Kevlar.
on Vader.
But they didn't want to call it Kevlar there. They wanted a more sexy name to it or something. It's armor weave.
So Vader's cape is like possibly bulletproof.
And you wanted to, so sorry, going back to the, should have brought this up in the, during the Mandalorian part. But you did want to make up a point about Crusader armor.
And in the comic books of Knights of the Old Republic, a lot of the Crusader armor, yes, is more focused on an element of conformity, but there's also a lot of variation. So there's a little bit of like conflicting material in what you read and what you physically see in the artwork of the comics. Like you can certainly see like, you know, different species mix in with the Mandalorian Crusaders, who are very evidently those species. You can see like a Mandalorian style armor adjusted for a Rodian physiology, or like a Wookiee, right?
Yeah.
And then it becomes even more conformed.
Is that a word? Or less conformed?
No, it becomes more uniform.
Oh, okay.
As you move into, because the comic books predate the video games.
Yes.
Like on the timeline.
Yeah.
And as you go into the video games, obviously it's like hyper conformed. Everyone is wearing like essentially the same armor in different colors.
Yeah.
So just a little bit of a distinction there I wanted to
Be kind of grading on a curve for like Mandalorian. What is conformity for a Mandalorian?
Yeah, exactly.
It's not the same as a Stormtrooper.
Right? Yeah, and conformity doesn't have to be exactly the same. It could be variations on a spectrum of closer to the same as your comrades. And by a similar virtue, like someone like Jaster's Super Commandos, they have very uniform color schemes, but then they have like unique patterns and designs that indicate unit numbers and or units. And then you also have the color schemes that they evolve into of like different missions and values of the individual who's wearing it. So,
yeah, I was looking at some like Jaster Mareel's like squads and like it's all like, yeah, you're right. There are the conform colors, but like some guys aren't even wearing like anything on their legs and some guys are. Yeah. And it's like, it seems to be like,
yeah, and you'll see like a vague palette.
Yeah.
But then like some guys' shoulder pads will be red and the other guys will be yellow. Some guys will be greens, and but they all kind of share the same colors. And then you have people like Montross is wearing like more gray blues.
Yeah.
So.
All right. And then sort of the last one we covered was the Royal Guard armor. Now, one thing, again, more conflicting sources, especially on these more like tertiary topics, there's always like, I feel like they haven't exactly
hammered out the details.
Yeah. Made like a canon on, but the Senate Royal Guard, like the Blue Guards, there's conflicting sources on their origins. I found some sources saying their origins are from, they're like based off the Mandalorians, others base them off the Sun Guards, and then like some sources base the Sun Guards off the Mandalorians, right? So it's sort of like, it's kind of a web that's hard to untangle.
Yeah. I think the in-universe justification would be that you can have multiple sources of inspiration at the same time.
Yes.
Or you have that legacy of inspiration. So maybe the Sun Guard were inspired by the Mandalorian. So if you base something off the Sun Guard, you are de facto also basing it off the Mandalorians. Or alternatively, you're looking at both suits and you're like, I like this feature of that suit, I like this feature of that suit, and then combining it into your new suit.
Yeah. So, yeah, for sure.
Even though they conflict, I think it's pretty easy to mentally make them fit.
Yeah,
which absolutely. I find I do a lot nowadays. But
yeah. And then you wanted to bring up the Vader samurai armor.
Oh yeah, just going back to Vader there. Obviously very much inspired in real world by samurai armor.
Yeah.
And his helmet almost has
yeah, it looks like a samurai helmet.
Yeah, it is, but also I was gonna say it was gonna be like an exaggerated German helmet.
Oh yeah, yeah.
The name Stahlhelm.
Okay.
Style, but with the back end that goes all the way down to the shoulder. Again, like it looks like a samurai helmet, but it feels like that again with the whole like Germanic pseudo space Nazi vibe. And funny story with that helmet is actually Saddam Hussein had a unit of soldiers that had Kevlar helmets shaped like Darth Vader's
Oh, really?
Helmet. Not the faceplate, but the helmet. And Yeah, it was made out of Kevlar, and they actually used it in combat. You can find photos of it. And it was inspired by Darth Vader. Like, Saddam Hussein saw Vader's helmet and thought that was cool. I want to equip my bad guys with that helmet.
So. Man, yeah, like... I think if you're going to try and ingratiate yourself to like Westerners, that's not going to be.
Or if you're just like, I am the bad guy. Yeah. I'm going to outfit my guys to look like the bad guys.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of funny. All right, Christian. So what was your favorite set of armor in this episode that we covered?
Honestly, you make this so hard. You pick like the three coolest suits of armor, in my opinion. It's hard for me to choose between.
And you have to pick one from, like, if it's Mandalorian, it can't just be any Mandalorian. Yeah. Because Mandalorian armor is pretty vast.
There's lots of different styles and helmets. And
it's changed over time. Over
time, too. Yeah. Darth Vader has always been my favorite, like, growing up, ever since I first saw him on screen. But the Mandalorian... armor is hard to beat, even from Vader. I might have to go with the modern. Oh, I don't know, man. Vader's pretty cool, and the Senate Guard has pretty cool armor, especially the armor plated version. Not so much the robe version of the Royal Guards, but their full plate armor. I'm gonna go with. You're killing me. Mandalorians. Mandalorians. And modern, like
modern Mandalorian.
Yeah, like Jango Fett.
Like more
full head to toe. Because even Boba Fett's missing like a lot of the leg armor.
Right, yeah.
But I like Jango in like the full suit. But color scheme would probably be like Boba Fett or Jaster's Super Commando color scheme.
Yeah. I think for me, like, I think it's just a sentimental is the Imperial Royal Guard armor. I've always loved just like the popping red color. I love the aesthetic of it.
No, it's sick. That's why it makes it so hard to choose, because that's my third favorite armor too. So it's like picking from
there. There's a lot. If you guys go out and look online, even like the Sun Guard armor is pretty cool. I really like that too. There's a lot, and I even like the Imperial Shadow Guard armor is pretty cool. There's not like a whole ton of info on it, but it's just like a cool concept having like a black red guard, you know. So
on that note, I always found those helmets, as cool as they look, a little bit hard to think of as in practical terms. It seems like turning
it almost doesn't look like there's a neck at all. You're right about that.
It loses points for functionality.
True. Well, anyways, I think that was good here at the Coruscant Museum of Armor.
I'm sure we'll be back again.
Yeah, we shall. All right, we'll see you guys later.